See Red Fred, and do you want to play See Red Fred's song here? He called, but I guess he couldn't hold because he was probably writing a new song for Giggle Water.
Oh, I thought it was Whippersnappers. No, it's Giggle Water.
Giggle Water, yeah. It's actually a good song, though. Listen to this voice.
Gar and Pax, they weren't that bad. Shabba-labba ding-dong. Bring back Gar and Pax by Christmas Day.
Awesome.
Who do they drive? MVP Rose. Who do they drive? Joe Kim Noah. Who do they drive? Jimmy Butler. What do I see under the tree? It's Laurie. Bring them back. Who didn't they drive? Nogo Mark. Who didn't they drive? Stand Still Pee Wee.
Who didn't they drive?
Dalen Terrible.
Take a look around. Get them out of town. It's a tire fire of epic proportions.
Bring back Gar and Pax. They weren't that bad. Shabba-labba ding dong. Bring back Gar and Pax. By Christmas Day.
Now, it is a Christmas song.
Is it
a famous Christmas song, or did he write that Christmas song?
I don't know. He wrote the chords.
Right. So if he wrote the chords, then it's not a parody of an existing holiday.
Which is a rule.
It's a great...
So he DM'd me. Sylvie, I swear... By all that I hold dear, I wrote every word of that song. I also wrote the melody and the chords. For years, from 1997 to 2025, I played in a 50s-60s band called Giggle Water. We were actually very successful in the Southwest Burbs, playing at Riley's Daughter in Bourbon Street until we were banned from playing in Chicago due to an unfortunate incident involving our band and some little people wrestlers. So my lifelong dream of performing at the Cubby Bear never quite happened, but I've kept writing songs in the Bulls parodies ever since. Everything I've written is on my musician page. I'll gladly admit I use modern tech to help shape the sound, but the lyrics, the music, the melody, that's all me. All Bulls parodies have a logo. All the other songs are originals from the Giggle Water days. If you'd like, I'd be happy to come on the show and talk through the process and the highly unconventional musical career I've had.
So it's an original Christmas song written by him. That's not a parody.
That is true.
He wrote the chords and the music, and am I wrong, fellas?
He clanked it.
I think it's a brilliant presentation, and I love it. But it doesn't fit inside the confines of the rules, I don't believe. Unless you can tell me which song that is a parody of.
Yeah.
That wasn't Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Let's get
you know what's weird is our good friend Fred's insatiable fixation on a below-average basketball team year in and year out.
Yeah, every year. He falls
That's what's
for
weird.
One
banana in the tailpipe,
yes.
Over and over and over again.
1 year he won't fall for it. 1 year,
no, that's not true.
You think this
of
is
course,
just...
Yes, this is who he is. This is in his DNA.
Like a month ago, he said he was out on Gar Pax until they made the Isaac Okoro deal.
Eversley and AK.
Yeah, sorry, yeah.
Bring back Gar and Pax. Shabba ding dong. All right.
Pretty close.
You want to see Red Fred here?
I do, yeah.
He's defending himself as to using AI and to making up a holiday song. What's up, Fred?
How you doing, guys? I love you, but I am highly dismayed by the accusation that AI wrote Bring Back Gar and Pax.
Not wrote.
No.
Perform
now. That.
We believe you on the writing now.
Okay.
Well, we want to know, is it a made-up song because it's supposed to be a holiday parody song? And also, the voice, like, why not perform it yourself?
What? I could sing. You want to hear me sing it? I mean,
No. Let's start. We trust that. Let's start with whether or not that is a parody of an existing holiday song or that was something new that you wrote.
It was a combination of a Perry Como song, a rare Perry Como song called Christmas Eve. And then I combined parts of the Nutcracker during the chorus. So technically, it's not one song,
okay,
but it's parts of two songs. Not a popular song, Perry Como, Christmas Eve. Everybody check it out. It's a fantastic tune. And I will admit,
we're
going
to have to convene
technology
on that.
It's like
not
your love for Isaac Okoro, too. Like, of course, you like one of the rarest Christmas songs ever.
What do you mean? We're 1-7 since the Coral got hurt. Like, I agree, this team's terrible. I'm not going to deny that, and I'm a broken man when it comes to the Bulls, but
again,
it's pretty obvious.
How many times can you be broken, though, Fred? Like, listen, I love you like an older brother or younger brother. I don't know how old you are, but, like, it's kind of tough love from me. I don't want you to continue to get out over your skis and wear your heart on your sleeve. And every time you do this, I feel for you, man. You like you take the cheese.
Mouse in the house.
Well, to take the cheese, we were dominating. We were on the pace for 70 wins, and I don't know, it just fell apart.
It was the first five games of an unimportant first 2 weeks of an NBA season.
Well, but we were beating Denver on the road. I mean, we were beating some good teams. You got to admit that. I mean, come on.
All right, that's neither here nor there. Let's hear you sing. I want to hear you sing a song like you would in Giggle Water.
How about sing the song that he wrote?
Let's hear.
I'll sing right now. Bring back Gar and Pax, they weren't that bad. Domalaga ding dong, bring back Gar and Pax by Christmas Day.
Why couldn't you do that? Why couldn't you just use your voice to begin with?
Because I like using technology to modify my voice, like Kanye, like other artists out there. I like using it.
Did you just compare yourself to Kanye? Talent. Is that what you just did, Fred?
At least when it comes to this, not in other areas of his life. Yes, I'd like to compare myself to Kanye in terms of
what are you party like Diddy
songs.
Too? Like what's going on, Fred?
I like to disguise my. We had a very bad experience when we got banned from Chicago, so I don't like to use my original voice.
What happened?
Anymore.
What happened?
We were a very popular band in. My goal was to play in Chicago, and the primary booking agency booked us for Little People Wrestling as the opening act. And when we showed up, it was actual ring with real Little People Wrestling, and we were like a 50s and 60s band. So we started playing Surfing USA, and people started throwing beer at us because, you know, that's not our demographic. And the next thing I knew, well, the lead wrestler, Meathead, jumped on stage and broke my Les Paul. So I got into this fisticuffs with this little person wrestler who hit me so hard in the diaphragm, I almost passed out. You ever seen a video of the guy getting shot with the cannonball? I mean, that's what it felt like. This guy was I say a little person. He was like a semi-quasi, you know, size of a 13-year-old boy. So he hit me in the chest, and it didn't go well. But
I could have never anticipated the story being as good as it is.
So long story short, they destroyed my musical equipment and my lower rib cage and my general pride, and we never played in Chicago again because we busted out with
just
that
show. Just change the name of your band, Fred!
Well, I was pretty well known back in the this is 2003. And
put
it was
on
a stone's
wig.
Throw away from Cubby Bear. So all my dreams were shattered on that.
Hey, we're back. My name's not Fred. Hey, we're back. My name's not
Tommy,
Fred.
Tommy, have you ever seen a little person wrestle? Have you ever seen a little person wrestle?
I'm not in person, Fred.
Well, let me tell you, they are scary people, and I advise no one to get in fisticuffs with little people wrestling.
I don't think you should fight with anyone, Fred.
No, either do I, but I thought I could handle myself pretty good. And then, you know, in front of my family and friends, I got my rear end kicked on a stage. So it was not a good moment.
I'm still there's so many facets to this story. I can't understand how you couldn't, like, you know, why can't you kind of rebrand yourself?
How powerful is this wrestling league that you can't perform anymore?
I love him showing up to the gig and then knowing that it's all these wrestlers. Damn it, we're still playing Surfing in the USA.
Well, yeah, I knew there was going to be a problem there because people were asking us to play Korn and all these other horrible bands from that era. And I'm like, that music sucks.
No,
and
it doesn't.
So we're gonna do our stuff, 50s and 60s music, Beatles, Elvis, Rolling Stones, and Beach Boys. I like opening up with Surfing USA. The crowd didn't like it. They throwed beer like it was a scene from the Blues Brothers.
I got an idea.
And then took my Les Paul and smashed it like he was Pete Townsend.
That's not good.
And yeah, I was enraged. I went at him.
This is what
opened up my chest and he hit me hard.
We have Fred. We pretend he's a finalist. He performs. We invite the same wrestling squad the event.
Yes, yes.
And we see if we can
rematch. Will you rematch them in Naperville?
I will never be. Listen, you don't know what I went through. I had to load my equipment in my crappy Saturn. Why this little person was making fun of me in the alley with a whole line of people trying to get in. I will never be around a little person wrestler again as long as I live. If he shows up, I'm leaving. I'm not dealing with it again.
We need you to call more about Nat Bowles. And just random
stuff. One of the best calls of the year.
Your best call ever.
I'm just trying to get respect as a songwriter and not being accused of being like an AI guy. I write songs. They're all up under C. Red Fred on Spotify and stuff.
I think your song,
and my career was ruined by a little person, wrestler. I'm saying
to you, Fred, I think your songwriting was spectacular. I'm only hung up on
that
right now on whether or not you violated the rules by not presenting a parody of an existing Christmas song.
All right, I will send those two songs, and I will abide by whatever the decision is. But I have talent when it comes to this art, and I'll be darned if I'll be accused of it being an AI guy.
And
I was so hurt with that. The lyrics, I mean, you heard me use Stand Still P-Will and Dalen Terrible for years on X.
All right,
I talk about those guys all the time.
Fred, it's a great call. It's a great call. Stay off the air with Bowles' thoughts. Keep calling with some music thoughts,
okay?
Favorite,
this is my favorite call of the year, I think.
Thanks,
well
guys.
Done, Fred.
There you go.
All right, have a good one, guys.
You're so on. Here's what we're going to do.
Yeah.
We're going to vote
him through.
We're going to vote him through. Yeah. And we're going to invite
little people wrestlers.
Even there just to intimidate them. Like, stand in the corner and just stand there like this. In their singlets. Do they wear singlets?
I don't know how they dress these days.
Is that what you call
most wrestlers do? Yeah, most wrestlers wear singlets and wrestling shoes.
We have to do this. We have to.
Hello again, everybody. Welcome to another exciting edition of the Big Red Bus as I take the glorious monstrosity out onto the streets of Chicago. I look to my right and all the way back to row 1000. It's completely empty bus. That clip you just heard was from the great Waddle and Sylvie show. I wrote Bring Back Gar and Pax and submitted it for the holiday parody contest, and we somehow got on the topic of my musical career. So I tried to bring you a little mirth to start this episode out with my tale of woe from 20 some years ago, any incident which, you know, basically ruined my music career. And I'll say this current Bulls team might ruin my podcasting career, but I'm going to fight through it, do my best to provide you, the listener, with some entertainment during this holiday season with some really high-quality parody songs, some more Bulls talk with the great one, Doug Tonis, and I hope to have another one of those episodes out with Doug later this week. The Bulls currently are pathetic 10-15. We're 11th in the East, you know, 11th. Gar Pax were stuck on 7. These guys are stuck on 11. We got a regular convenience store of a front office right now going really well. So that Pelicans loss, another in a long line of embarrassing, pathetic efforts. And so Doug and I will hopefully get a show out to you later this week to talk about the current state of the team. But in the interim, here's part two with the great Joel Lorenzi, Bulls beat writer for The Athletic. You can hear part one in episode 229. We get into a bit more Bulls-centric discussion. And this part, keep in mind, it was recorded before the massive downturn, but it's all pretty much timeless topics. So I hope you enjoy it. And in the interim, please check out From the Gigawater Day some of my original tunes and Bulls parodies, more modern songs that I wrote. I think I have 6 up on most platforms under C. Red Fred as an artist. So I'll include the artist page link in the show notes if you're interested in listening. So on to the interview with the rising superstar, Joel Lorenzi. Until next time, go Bulls.
I did want to go back to Josh Giddey. So you were there in Oklahoma City with Josh Giddey. Talk a little bit about that situation. First of all, I've become a full-fledged Giddey. I love Josh Giddey. I'm 100% behind him. I was not happy about the trade for the simple reason is that I could not believe we weren't able to garner any additional draft assets. From your perspective, let's go back to that time. Were you surprised the Bulls didn't demand more draft assets for Josh Giddey? I know it's worked out. I always bring this up. Like, I don't care, you know, if Max Christie makes 25 All-Star appearances. The trade was stupid because they should have got more in return on that initial one. That's kind of how like I feel about. Obviously, it's not that bad, but
that trade was stupid because they got off Luka Doncic. Yeah. That's why that trade was stupid. But no, I agree. I mean, the thinking at OKC, I remember being there and how down people were on Josh Giddey, and fans like damn near throwing a parade in the streets that day because they're like, we didn't get off any draft pick. And it's not just the fact of like that makes sense while doing business, but like it's because of who you're doing business with. OKC has more draft picks at one time than maybe any team ever, and certainly more than any team has ever needed, even with the CBA. So it's
more than they can use. More than they can
right. More than they can use. And it's crazy because now I'm looking at some of the teams they snipe picks from they have, I mean, this is a disaster for the league. The Clippers pick this year, they have a Dallas pick in there in the next 2 years. They have a Denver pick, which isn't nearly as bad as those two. But they have a Denver pick somewhere here, maybe 2 or 3 years down the line. Like, they have some absurd picks. And those are just, I mean, sure, it's more than they can certainly use and draft with. But these are, like, godly assets. You're right. I think that was sort of baked into this. So people, when they saw that in OKC, they're like, yo, what? Because people were extremely, extremely down on Giddey. And that was kind of just, in hindsight, that was just the lens of this team. I think people weren't sure if they were on the brink of a championship or not. And so they're like, he fit in this poorly and had kind of been, the core had sort of accelerated past him, and they lost to Dallas in the second round. Like, it became clear, like, this team is a dynasty. And he just didn't fit with them because the guy who took the ball out of his hands was Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, probably a top 30 player all time already, currently.
Just about.
And so, you know, like I remember people, like, celebrating over – but in hindsight, like, yeah, they probably should have used that idea of Josh and how down people around the league were to be like, okay, well, if you really want to get off him, like – give us a pick. Give us one pick, the worst of all these picks, which would still be some asset. I did think that part was crazy, but also I do wonder, because the thing that became clear was that if nobody had an offer that they cared for, which I wonder how much budging it would have took to get Sam off of one pick, because they clearly thought Caruso was their guy. Like the way I wish I could make an analogy to another sport here, but like, this was clearly the guy they thought would be their championship closer in baseball or something. I don't know, you know, like
yeah, and it worked. It worked. He was
right.
Player on the team.
It worked.
How else you can make
yes.
It, you know, so like,
it worked.
It's crazy. Like, you know, in fairness, Acme deserves credit. He did get Giddey, and it's working out. But again, we can't evaluate the trade. It's got to be evaluated in context. And I'm so glad I'm talking to you about this, because people look at me like I'm nuts now that I'm a huge Giddey fan, but I also realized that was a mistake. You know, for Matt, he did another.
And the thing I'll say, and I won't cut you off after this. The thing I'll say, I do wonder, Sam is crazy enough to have stopped fielding offers, I think, entirely. I mean, I think the Bulls were the one team he really wanted to deal with. Like we said, the importance of Caruso. They were the one team. They were the only team with a Caruso, with a guy who can sort of add to this defensive-leaning championship team. And so I think really, if it took some budging and further negotiations, I mean, you saw how much of the summer they took to give Giddey a deal. I think they probably could have got some capital, which is what bugs me in hindsight, because while I think Sam was crazy enough to bring Giddey off the bench, even disgruntled as he was, that was kind of what became clear in the aftermath. He wanted Giddey. I mean, that was his guy, right? Like Sam is a guy who sees picks through. Josh was like his baby almost, and he wanted to see him through as his bench facilitator, which became a need. Obviously, AJ Mitchell's sort of come out of that. All these draft picks, they've kind of found this bench facilitator. Topic is supposed to be that, but he obviously is going through a tough time now with his diagnosis, and I'm rooting for him.
Yes.
But, you know, like, he was willing to throw Josh off the bench, and Josh was the one who was like, no. So if you really did have to find a suitor and you knew you really wanted Caruso, like, I thought AK should have leveraged that better.
Yeah. Do you feel that Caruso was a difference in them winning the title, like that addition?
Yes. No, for sure. I don't even know why I thought about that. Yes. Especially because he elevated his play in the playoffs. Like, I remember earlier in the season talking to him in San Antonio, because he was shooting like an abominable, like 15% from three or something like that. And it was like, people were wondering. And I don't know that that was like unique to his career. He'd have a stretch here in one season where it's like he was kind of average. And then he'd have another season where for the whole season he was a sharp shooter. And so people were like, what version of Caruso are we going to get? And he's like, man, I've been through this. I played so long. Like, I'm not tripping at all. And he hit big shots, not just throughout the season, but especially in the playoffs. He gave you 20 points. This dude had, you can count on his on your hand how many 20-point games he had during the season. And then in the playoffs, I think he had two in the finals. Yeah. Like, he was incredible, dude.
Yeah.
And not only that, but if the Denver series is the one you're looking at, like, yeah. Oh, if that sort of defined who they are as a team. Like, that not just getting over the Jokic hump and defeating Jokic, but, like, gaining confidence as a team. Like, okay, we can knock off a team like that. We could face adversity. We could go to a seven-game series and really come out of it alive and rejuvenated. That series did everything for them. And I know it's still a point of contention, and it contributes to this conversation of, oh, well, what is defense in the league? What does OKC get away with? Caruso had a masterclass defending Jokic in that game seven, and it changed the series. I mean, decided the series. And, like, I thought it was a masterclass from the coaching staff to say, like, hey, this is kind of the, if you're an official, it's hard to call all this knick-knack stuff on Caruso when he's defending a guy who has, like, maybe, I'm not even going to try to guess how many pounds Jokic has on him. Certainly, say 7 or 8 inches of height on him. It was smart to lean into that. And Caruso is a guy who's known for scaling up. I think, like we talked about Okoro, the idea of Okoro is that he can scale up. You don't want him to, though, as much as he does. Caruso, I thought, has always been fine with scaling up.
Oh.
And it was perfect. And it decided the series, and it ultimately made their championship run. And he gives you 2 20-point games in the finals. Like, what more could you ask for a dude you just traded for? And it became pretty apparent that he belonged there, like, early in the season, even when the shooting was a struggle.
He's the absolute perfect piece for a defense that is so switchable. I mean, it's the most versatile defensive roster I've ever seen, probably. It's just amazing what they could do in terms of switching, and it completely nullifies a really good pick and roll. The team is phenomenal, and I love watching them play defense. Your favorite player you ever covered so far?
Favorite player I've ever covered? I'm going to lean NBA here. I talked about the environment at OKC, but I still like – I mean, that was an incredible locker room to be around. Like, those dudes were funny as hell. We were all the same age. I was this is going to seem lazy. I'll actually do superlatives here just because it was so hard to pick from that team. I thought Caruso was the one guy I always tried to find after a game to get his thoughts on something, because he's obviously so cerebral. He's seen so many basketball pictures, and he could give you, like, a punchy quote. I always liked that about Caruso. So it was cool to be around him. And on this team that seriously lacked vets, like, he was the vet. So I thought Caruso was fun to cover there. J-Dub was eclectic, eccentric, and for all those reasons, I thought he was funny as hell to be around, and the life of the party, even if sometimes it comes off as performative, J-Dub was fun as hell, maybe the funnest player I covered. Chet Holmgren, I really appreciated covering just because he was kind of like, he was very thundery. Like, all the things I described about the Thunder's operation, he was super thundery and super bought in. He bathes in their Kool-Aid. And he was very cynical, which I kind of liked about Chet because I am cynical myself. And then Shea was just an absolute delight to cover. That dude, I think he thought he was a poet. So he would try to – you could tell, like, the later in the first year I was around, and then definitely throughout that championship season, he was trying to be real eloquent in post games, which was the only time we could ever talk to him. We never got him on shoot around or anything. So post games were like his sort of stage to be this poet that you see in the IG captions. And I thought it made him, I thought he was always a really interesting thinker and a good quote and never really an issue to cover. So Shea's up there for me. I imagine, like, hopefully I cover the NBA for decades. He's maybe the best player I'll ever cover on a beat. Probably the best player I'll ever cover on a beat, unless the Bulls uncovered something here. That dude is great, and he was a delight to cover. So those are my superlatives and why I generally enjoy covering that team.
what about this Bulls team? Like, let's get your thoughts a little bit. Number one, who's the leader of the team? Number two, like, who do you really have special relationships with? Or building?
Yeah, right, building. Building's is so, perfect word.
Yeah.
I think Vooch is a big leader on his team. The leader is I don't know if I'd use the leader, because it does seem like they're trying to get voices from different directions. But if there is the leader, like, Vooch is probably the closest thing. I think they care about Josh's voice. Zach Collins' voice seems to matter. So it is interesting because it's a touchy thing when you're talking about identity and who are you willing to ship for. Like, obviously, it's business and you want to build the best team. So this stuff has to be, like, secondary. But it does matter when you're talking about building a culture. Like, OKC built a culture that didn't really depend on a certain player, which is why I thought they could swap out whatever pieces they wanted. But some players' voices do matter, and I think Vooch's voice does matter as we talk about trade targets and stuff like that. I think Vooch is very easy to cover. He's a consummate pro. This is not news, but Vooch is super easy to cover. I think Josh, obviously, we have a decent relationship just because when all this stuff was going on at OKC, that was actually my first month on the beat when he had the public allegations. And so they sheltered him for reasons that I think as a brand made sense for them. Like, obviously, he was a kid. He is a relative kid, I guess, still. Like, he's pretty young. So I can see why they want to protect him from some of that stuff. But I'm getting to know him now, and it's easy going guy, easy to get to know. Kobe White, Kobe's very cool to deal with. So yeah, there's some
gotta be earth.
It's very easy to talk to some of these dudes on this team, and Trey Jones is easy to talk to too. Like, I can honestly go down the list. I haven't had issues. I do enjoy talking to Modest, based on his ambition alone. Like, he wants everything. Like, he wants the world in his hands, I think. And obviously, I think Bulls fans want him to seize that because it seems like he could be very important. So I don't know. I get those impressions when I talk to him, and it's been fun to get to know him. But it's still very early and knowing all these guys, so we'll see how it shapes up. But it's been – I mean, I've been around the team now for maybe 2-3 months, and it's been – fun as hell, dude. I mean, this is what covering the NBA should feel like. So the fact that it's felt like this pretty immediately is pretty cool.
That's great to hear. And I will admit, I am a massive Kobe fan. I just believe in the kid so much. We've put a ceiling as a fan base on Kobe White every single year. I've had, you know, my nemesis online, Mark Kay from Australia, who's a friend slash nemesis, say that he thought, you know, like, he should be a sixth man as little as 2 years ago. Like, all this nonsense. The guy, to me, is like, he's a superstar now. I just don't think we've realized it. He was the best player in Eastern Conference in March, was voted as such in these last two games. Like, what else does this kid have to do? Hits the three, gets the line, shoots at 90% rate. He's like a 50-40-90 guy eventually, potentially. He's got massive gravity. I freaking love Kobe White. I don't get it. Like, why is
he
25? It's like crazy.
No, he's young as hell. This just popped into my head as I think about team builds. I'm not ready to call him a superstar yet. I do appreciate the optimism for it, because I do think he is a hell of a player. I don't think he's pretty close to being a star. Like, if we're that definition is obviously like loose, he's pretty close to being a star specifically because of the free throw rate and how much he gets there. Like, that's a pretty good star indicator. I know people are going to beef about who he is as a defender. Same with Giddy, and the fact that they're next to each other doesn't make it any better as defensive lens goes. I think that's on the team to build a team that can anchor them better, frankly.
Yes.
So that we're not talking about them in this light. Because, I mean, for years, and these are different archetypes, different builds, everything is so nuanced and late. But, like, we love the Dame and CJ teams right? Like, I know I did, and they achieved some good things. They went to the conference finals when the Warriors ran at that conference, and so, you know, like, they should be trying to aim higher than those Blazers teams, but, like, we always saw that as a formidable backcourt, and similarly, like, these guys are very offensive-leaning, not great as defenders at the moment, either of them. But I could see why, you know, you'd call Kobe White a star. And I specifically love the free throw rate when I talk about him as a star, because it is it's an easy star indicator. But again, I don't know his perception. It's hard to change his perception when the defense around them caves so often. You can't hold them up as scorers. The scorers and playmakers that he and Giddy are, like, we're always going to come back to the glaring weaknesses because of the team build. So as far as your superstar case, it might be a while.
All right. Last two topics, Joel. You've been more than generous with your time, and I can't thank you enough. Sure. I did want to get a little bit into Modest because, and I'm of the belief, and I think it's tied to Billy Donovan. So these two are the last two topics. Like, a lot of fans were outraged. He didn't play a lot last year, and I totally disagreed with it. Like, I didn't think he deserved to play for the first half of the year. I think that was proven when he finally got the starting spot and he was terrible for the first 10 games. Then he grew because he's a young player, and you don't throw young players out there to lose confidence and to just, you know, learn when they're not capable of it. Number one, it'll also breed, you know, contempt from his teammates. So you got to earn it. He allowed him to do that. Now he's a starter. That said, like, he's up and down to me a lot more than people want to acknowledge, especially in the defensive end. Everybody's furious. Well, he's pulling him at the end of games, and he's not playing often or whatever. I see a lot of issues on the defensive side of the ball with Modest, and I understand why Billy gets frustrated there. But you also do see the incredible talent and the potential ability to be one of the best players in the league. He's got the talent. Like, what can he do? What are your thoughts on Modest and how Billy Donovan specifically is handling him?
Yeah, obviously I spent so much time around the Thunder last year, so you can go back on your impressions of him from afar, and obviously I went back and watched some of the tape from last year, but like the preseason and camp, like those are your summer league, those are your early impressions of who he is now and what they want him to be, and once he's kind of loosened his leash of Billy, at least that was what I thought it was going to be coming to the season. Like those are the impressions that matter. And so I'm thinking, like, you know, like if the this is like when you're thinking of a team without Kobe White being part of the template. Obviously, he changes so much, but like they were without him throughout all the camp. So if Indiana Light is sort of the template here, and which you're using as the thing to justify your team building strategy, I'm thinking, okay, well, who's who here to sort of justify that? Like, and what makes Indy go? Indy goes because Tyrese Halliburton is this really cerebral playmaker, arguably probably top three playmaker in the league. I want to give some love to Jokic here.
No doubt.
And so, like, that's obviously why he goes. And not only that, he elevates in the postseason. He elevated in the postseason. He had one of the craziest postseason runs I've seen since I've watched basketball. And he could elevate and hit clutch shots when he needed to. So that's one thing to live up to. The next thing is that Pascal was this really scalable scorer who can guard multiple positions if you need him to, and could handle and pick and roll and create late clock and do all these things. And he's super underrated. Like, that's their second option, and I think he's better than people give him credit for. Mm-hmm. And so is that who Modest is supposed to be? That was kind of what I was looking at coming into the season, if this is what we're looking at, was the team build template. And, you know, their archetypes, in theory, are not all that different. Like, you want Modest to guard multiple positions, in theory. You want him to handle the ball and maybe conduct some pick and rolls as the handler, in theory. And now obviously they're different athletes, they have different strength. Modest's handle to me right now is not close to Pascal's, and it's not close to serviceable right now. I think there are a couple moves he can really get to that are nice and help him in the half court, but I generally think that it's been tough these first few weeks for him to get to a spot just because of the handle being limited. And then the defense, you mentioned the defense, like defending without fouling is such a big deal for him. He's been in foul trouble almost every game this season to start. And part of that is the Bulls pounding the table over physicality and wanting a certain level of physicality to make up for the fact, again, that their rim protection is not good. And so you're trying to – it's a compromise, right? And I think Modest historically has been into physical basketball. You talk to the people who trained him and who he grew up with, and physicality is his thing. But it's his frame and the style – These things have to catch up. His body has to catch up to what Billy is asking of him and what the NBA is asking of him. And I just don't think they have yet. And we could argue about this too, what body weight he should be at to still be able to do things he should be able to do and likes to do, and his strengths right now, flying through the air, like what body weight should he be at? Because then you're talking about a different compromise if he has to gain weight and, put on some real size here. So there are so many nuances to the development of Modest, but I do think it's been interesting to see how much he's been in foul trouble and the subsequent leash Billy has had for him. Like, I thought he had an incredibly short leash for him the other night in Portland. Like, and that wasn't even off foul. That was off turnovers. And again, those are the two issues for me, the handle and dealing with the physicality and the foul trouble, defending without fouling. So this is a natural point of progression for him. And I don't know what the answer is for him. Maybe he puts on more weight. I don't think he wants to put on a ton of bulk just because it sounds like he's very cognizant of the idea that his agility against people at his position and his vertical and that sort of aspect of his athleticism are those are his home run like factors in his makeup and archetype. So I don't know that he wants to put on a ton of size, but like this is kind of the dilemma he's dealing with. And we know Billy, it don't take much. Like Noah hasn't even played, and a lot of it is because of his frame. So it don't take much for Billy to say, well, hey, you got to work on this. I know a big thing this past week was, and I'm going to write about this, so a big thing this past week was that clip of Modest that surfaced from that podcast where they're talking about the film session. I don't know if you saw this.
I saw
the film. Yeah. Right. Okay. So the film session where he throws up, it's actually a very Shea-esque move where I don't know where it was in the clock, but he bumps somebody on the baseline and he gets up a midi, which for some players, that is a good shot. And apparently Modest's recollection of it was the next day they're in the film room. And Billy tells him, hey, throw that shit away. And Modest is like, okay, got it. And so we come back to standards here. Like, it depends on who people want Modest to be, who he thinks he should be, where he fits into the sort of Pacers template, which is maybe not one for one. But if he's going to be Pascal or even a player worth their salt as a second option, like, you have to have some deliberation about what shots need to be included in his development. I don't know if the bump fade necessarily needs to be there, but maybe it's some other variation of a late clock shot. And I don't think Billy's issue with that, from what I understand, was the shot itself as much as it was when he took the shot, the point in the game, the point in the clock, what other actions or options were on the table at the position. Again, I don't remember where that was in the clock, but I think his idea was that it was late in the clock. And so There's so much to talk about with Modest's development, and I just think he is at a rough patch that begs questions about his frame and who he wants to be. I do think Kobe coming back and this sort of depth they have kind of puts less pressure on him to develop as rapidly. Like, I thought coming into the season, like, so much of what they wanted to do this year was going to hinge on him coming into it and looking like he did in the preseason close to every game. And it hasn't been that. Like, he's kind of fallen, not behind, but like It's been Nothing. Easier to hide him in the box score than it had been preseason, right? And it's because Jalen Smith is taking off and their bench scores 60 points a game and they do all these crazy things. I think that's helped him, that it is not as much weight on him. But also, like, at a certain point, you have to wonder about the runway and timelines. It's year two, so I think people shouldn't be trying to rush him. But, you know, you have to look at the lens of Modest and his development and what this patch means through the lens of, like, hey, who do you think he should be? I mean, what is your player count for him, Fred? Like, I don't know who he should be.
Well, I'm a little bit concerned when you said that he's not sure he wants to add weight. To me, like, I can't even believe it. Like, to me, even he gained, what, 10 pounds, 15 pounds of muscle from last year? He needs 10 or 15 more. Part of the reason we struggle so much on you know, giving up offensive rebounds is his fault. He's just not strong enough. And I don't know who he thinks he is. Like, to me, he's a four, a modern-day four, and he's got to embrace that. I still have a nightmare from last year watching the Pistons destroy us two games in a row. This is one of his first 10 games that he started. And one of the first plays of the game, Asar Thompson just literally just dribbled straight into his chest and dunked it. And it's like, dude, you can't be that weak. And he's a lot better than he was, but it's still not acceptable to me. And I hope he realizes it. I understand I want to still be a high flyer and all that nonsense. That's fine. Dude, you got to get strong. I just don't even understand, like, do you think that conversation's been had with him? Like, is this a debate internally?
I don't want to speak too firmly on this, but I know I've talked to him about it some. I think he knows he's very confident of what his strengths are, and I don't disagree. Like, I think a lot of guys could stand to use 10 to 15 more pounds of muscle. I mean, it's just not body fat, it's muscle. And so, like, I don't even know that 10 to 15 pounds would really compromise who he is, the way he maybe thinks or the way it's been talked about.
Yeah.
But, and especially because, like, I don't know the because it makes you wonder, like, okay, the verticality is what people suggest, right? Like, would be the compromise if he added 10 to 15 more. But, like, when does he use it? It's not really being used. If it's used in a half court, he's a cutter, which I don't think would change with some muscle. If it's used anywhere else, it's in transition, which that doesn't matter. You go from maybe doing 360 windmills to doing back scratchers, like, so I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting conversation. One that, lucky for him and Bulls fans, I don't think it needs to happen midway. That's obviously a tough transformation to do during the season. I don't think it needs to happen now. I think what he's struggling with are perfect things to struggle with right now. The handle and understanding how to get to your spots, which is a very normal thing for a player in their second year. And then some of the other functional stuff and the physicality. Like, I think he'll learn some tricks of the trade along the way here and how to defend without fouling. Just as far as strategic and staying honest, like, some defensive measures without the frame. And then I think it's perfectly fine and certainly necessary to revisit the conversation next summer. Like, hey, do we need to change your body here? Obviously, I don't know that it ever needs to be like a Giannis type transformation, but something serviceable, like you say, to be closer to Pascal.
Look at Giannis where he was in year one and two, where he is now. It's like a different human being. And I just think, like, I understand his concern. I don't want to lose the 2 or 3 inches in verticality if I'm going to get bulkier. And my counter to that is, dude, they had Okoro on Lauri Markkanen. You can't be that weak that the Billy Donovan trusts 225-pound Isaac Okoro, who's 6'5", who's about 10 pounds stronger than you, I would guess, 10 or 15 pounds more in weight, a muscle, than having you as that option. And even on Banchero, when they played Orlando, he had Okoro on Banchero. And you know what? I understand why. Because there's no way that he's strong enough to guard Banchero in Modest. And, like, this has to be discussed. Like, I'm sure I trust Billy, and I'm sure they're going over this with him. But, like, to me, that's been a big issue. And it's not like I didn't expect it because he was so weak last year. He's definitely stronger this year, and he sees so much talent on the offensive end. But, like,
yeah,
defensively, I feel like he's in this weird spot right now where he's not strong enough to guard fours. And, you know, he's athletic, but he's not quick enough necessarily laterally to guard the best threes.
Yeah, and for what it's worth, like, rehashing my conversations with him about this, I do think that, like, he talks about getting stronger. Like, it's obviously something he wants. He wants to get stronger. Nobody wants to be puny in the NBA. But I do wonder, and it's my job to sort of understand his outline of what the final evolution of him is as a Pokemon, so to speak, of what that strength looks like in the end. I certainly think we could rule out anything remotely close to Giannis, something that would make him able to play five. I don't think he ever wants to get to a weight where
they're
considering playing him five. But I do think he wants to get to a weight where he's not fouling out because he's guarding Franz Wagner and Paolo Banchero, who already spend so much more time than he needs in the mid-range. Like, I thought that was the second game of the season, and it was an indicator, like, okay, here are some of the things he's in store for, because Paolo's, you know, I mean, that was his first game fouling out. I think he's fouled out again since then, and he's got at least six games. I don't remember the exact count. At least six games with four fouls, I think, and we're 14 games in. So it's an issue, but it's something he clearly wants to address. And I do think the way they talked about it is that, you know, it's a physicality thing. You got to be more physical. And it's like, I don't think Modest is lacking physicality. I think he's lacking the facilities to exact that physicality and to sort of get this benefit of the doubt from officiating crews, because he cannot put this current weight into the game the way he thinks at this point. You make a good point.
Joel, I can't tell you how enjoyable this conversation was. Before we go and I bring the bus into the garage, tell us where everybody can find you, every social media platform and article where we can read your work.
Absolutely. So you can find me on Twitter at Joel X Lorenzi. So that's JOELX. And people have asked if I'm a Malcolm X follower. It's just my middle initial, Xavier. Mm-hmm. I'll think about changing my byline at some point. Joel X Lorenzi is where you find me on Twitter. And at The Athletic, which is owned by the New York Times. So if you go to the New York Times website and go to the sports section, you can go to The Athletic and you can find me either under the Bulls tab. We have teams divvied up by tab, and you can follow our Bulls coverage. I'll be most of the bylines there because I am our Bulls beat writer. That's not to say I won't write other stories on other teams, namely the Thunder, as the year goes on, but I am dedicated to being this Bulls voice for the New York Times. So you can find me on the Bulls tab, or you can search up my byline, Joel Lorenzi, no X, and you will find all my stuff. And for what it's worth, like, I know some people have been confused by my rhythm or my coverage so far. I don't know that people can expect a lot of game stories from me. It's not something the Times is emphasizing. I think there are times when a game will prompt a story for me. Like, the other night was obvious. Like, Vooch, the sort of duality of Vooch, where he's this guy who can win you games but also can kind of bury you with that rim protection. That was such an obvious time to write that.
He'll get upset. I try to be real about it. I love Vooch, but, you know, and Cowley likes to rewrite history. Like, I was there when in 23-24 when Vooch shot 29% from three. That was not on high volume. That was a nightmare. Because guess what? His value is pretty much tied to his ability to stretch the floor as a five. So, like, I don't know. Like, did you have a
conversation? Absolutely. and you know what's crazy? Me and Callie talked about this. We talked about you. Callie, say what you want about Callie.
Yeah, I love
that dude is authentic. He's funny as hell. This beat has been crazy so far. He's been a big reason why. But I just said all that to say that, you know, people probably should be turning to Callie for game coverage. I don't know that I'll write it off a ton of games. That just happened to be off a game because Vooch, you know, won them a game. And it opened this door to have this conversation about Vooch centered around the way Klingon kind of threw him around. And then, you know, Vooch got the last laugh. So, but I'm dedicated to being a voice. You can find me there or on Twitter. I am engaging in these conversations. The one conversation I've yet to engage in over at The Athletic is the Anthony Davis conversation, which if it continues to heat up, maybe I'll have to. But I really don't want to, Fred, so.
Cool. You're the best, man. Thanks so much for coming out. What an addition to this group, you know, with Kali, who I love, the GOAT, Will Gottlieb is a genius, Casey Johnson. I don't know if you met Drew. Obviously, he's a
I love Drew. Incredible. I love Drew. This is a man. It's a crazy crew we got here, man. Yeah.
I just love the whole. I learned so much from all you guys. Joel, have a fantastic weekend, and thank you so much for coming on Big Red Bus. We got to have you on again, hopefully before the year's out, in the second half of the year. Would that be okay if I can commit you to that in front of our national audience?
I'm committed, man. You got my number now, so just hit me, man.
Joel, you're the best, man. Thank you so much.